Welcome to the Making Waves at Sea Level podcast with your host, Tom Singer. In each episode, we will explore the interesting stories of business executives, entrepreneurs, and industry leaders who are shaking things up and growing their companies. It is time to make some waves. Now here's your host, Tom Singer.
Hey, you have found your way to another episode of Making Waves at Sea Level. Thank you so much for always coming along on the journey of this podcast. And if this is your first time listening to Making Waves at Sea Level, my gosh, welcome, welcome, welcome. I hope you'll come back. We are almost approaching 700 episodes. I think we just crossed the 650 mark. Sometime this year we'll hit 700. And I never dreamed the show would last more than 6 months. It was supposed to be 50 episodes 7 years ago, and here we still are interviewing really interesting people who are making waves in the world of business. Now, before I get started with today's show, I have to thank the first sponsor of this episode. So this episode is brought to you by Stanton Chase International, one of the leading global executive search firms serving as trusted advisors to help companies build their senior leadership teams. Now, a little bit of full disclosure, I now work for Stanton Chase International, and it's probably the best company I've ever worked for, so I'm glad that they're sponsoring this show. Now, today, we are going to talk about how to make your ideas irresistible. Do you have ideas, and are people resisting them? See, you want to know this stuff. Today, our guest is my friend, Tamsin Webster, and she is just releasing a brand new book called Find Your Red Thread, Make Your Big Ideas Irresistible. And what Tamsin does is she is an English to English translator. Think about that for a minute. What she does is works with experts who have lost the ability to speak in their native tongue. Sometimes we get caught up in all that corporate speak and things like that. Tamsin helps people grab that red thread and pull it through everything that they do. She helps people translate how they talk about their ideas so people can understand them and act on them. And no matter where you are on that corporate ladder, whether you're a solopreneur, an entrepreneur, or a corporate leader, this is really important to you. So that's why I invited Tamsin to the podcast. Hey, Tamsin, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, I'm delighted to be here. And hello, listeners.
So I am so glad you're here. Now, I've known you for a long time. Could you please just start off and tell us the origin of the whole idea of the red thread? Because I love this story.
Oh, sure. So the red thread that your audience may have heard of before, I mean, there's lots of red threads, but the red thread that really caught my attention was a Swedish idiom that people use to describe the things that makes things make sense, like the theme of something, the meaning, the lesson. I would, you know, if you read a report or see a presentation, you're like, okay, well, what's the red thread here? What's the big idea? And I love that expression. I just thought it was very evocative. And I wanted to know, like, where did that come from? And so I went digging and I discovered that they believe the origin of that particular red thread is the Greek myth of Theseus and the Minotaur in the labyrinth. And the short version is that the red thread is the means by which Theseus found his way to the Minotaur and then, most importantly, back out again as he was trapped in the maze.
So I just love that as the themology of what you teach. So you've done a lot of things. You've had kind of an eclectic career. So let's take us back to the early days of Tamsin. How did you get started in business? And let's go through kind of quickly what led you to where you are today.
Sure. So growing up, I wanted to be an art museum director because, sure, that's what everyone does. But I also wanted to be really employed. So started back in undergrad. So quick version, undergrad, studied business, also American studies. Grad school, right after that, studied organizational behavior, also arts administration. Went to work, was briefly lured into corporate consulting as a change management consultant, but it was an enduring turn. I decided that it or Texas didn't like me very much and then went back to my dream of working in museums.
Wait a minute, I didn't know you were in Texas for a while.
I missed that
part of the story. I live in Texas. How could Texas not love you?
Well, because I was in Dallas, not in Austin. Well,
that answers it all right there. Okay, go on.
That's what I'm saying, right? I was a Mustang for grad school. So went to Cox School of Business and Meadows School for the Arts. And then worked briefly for Pritchett & Associates. Actually, I worked there while I was still in still in grad school, and then a little bit afterwards. Worked in a museum as the head of exhibition planning for about 3 years. Then to the Boston Conservatory, was the head of marketing. From there to Harvard Medical School, where I was the head of fundraising communication strategy. And then I flipped to the other side of the fence and started working with agencies and firms. So I worked with a brand strategy firm, an advertising agency. I was in charge of their content and social strategy, and then a boutique sales messaging training firm. And then about 5 years ago, I went out on my own doing what I do now.
Now, I first ran across you around that time because you were also the main curator for TEDx Cambridge. And Correct. You worked with a lot of people who had to give or chose to give TEDx presentations, and you helped coach them through. And the interesting stat, and I'm making this up in my head, if I remember it wrong, please correct me. The interesting stat was, for a long time during your tenure, you had more videos from your TEDx event get upgraded to the TED main channel than any other TEDx that was out there. And a lot of that, according to our mutual friends, was because of the excellent coaching you did, helping people get their message clear.
Well, thank you. And I think the most accurate way to say is our proportion, because at TEDx Cambridge, we only had 6 or 7 speakers at a time. But of the, at that point, I've coached now 50, and I'm still working with them as the idea strategist, out of about 50 folks that I've worked with on their TEDx, 7 of them have been promoted to TED.com. And that is a high percentage.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. So along the way, through all of that eclectic background and working with the TED speakers and things like that, one of the things that you did was you focused on this fact that a lot of people lose that ability, as you put it, to speak their native language. So why is it important for people in business to be able to clearly be able to articulate their ideas, have that red thread that can guide them back?
Well, nothing happens without it, right? I mean, that's, there's a wonderful quote by Agatha Christie who says that words are only the outer clothing of ideas. And if your words aren't good, if they don't really encapsulate the idea, then that idea gets lost. So, I've given all the time that I've spent in nonprofits in the arts world, I've always been very much dedicated to, ideas that are bigger than us, and really drawn to people of deep passions and deep expertise that have spent a long time learning about, discovering, researching, working on, building companies around these big ideas. And it would just pain me to see that here is this amazing idea, and it was getting lost in the language of the industry or the language of the company or the language generally of the expert. And yet there are all these people that really could get practical, useful day-to-day benefit out of it, but it really was just getting lost in translation. And that was particularly true, I could see, when helping with the TEDx Cambridge speakers, because those are scholars and researchers and academics, and they're pretty much used to talking to other scholars, researchers, and academics. But the test of a TEDx talk, as you know, having given one, is that it's a lay audience. They may be very educated and quite intellectual, but they are not going to be a whole group of fellow scientists. And so it became a really interesting problem for me to continue to solve. So however eclectic my background has been, it really has always been about that one thing, because no matter where I have been or what my title has been, I've really been like a human Rosetta Stone, trying to figure out how to take these theoretical, ideological, aspirational ideas and make them practical and get people to see how they can actually work in real life.
So, and businesses have a really bad habit of getting caught up in industry speak, right? So it's like, even if their customers know the industry, there seems to be a lot of inside baseball that goes on inside companies and inside industries that really don't translate to talking to customers or marketing, et cetera. So what are some of the lessons that businesses, executives can learn from this book?
Well, I think that one of the biggest shifts, I would say there's three big ideas. One is that the best, most irresistible kind of story, the most irresistible way to get an idea across so that people act on it is to build not your case for the idea, but your audience's case, your team, your employees, your customers, your prospects, to build the case that they would make for your product. Because if you think about it, ultimately, they will have to make that case. And if it's not in language that is comfortable for them, if it's not rooted in things that are relevant to them, if it's not consistent with their worldview and their company's worldview, that great idea, your amazing product, going to die on the vine. So that's one of the biggest things. I'd say the second big thing is that in part of building someone else's case for your idea comes a pretty counterintuitive approach, which is, a lot of times when we're trying to get people to change their thinking or behavior, which is fundamentally, I think, what most leadership is all about, we think we have to change what people want and what they believe. But the reality is those are the two most difficult things to change. We can't get people to unwant things that they want. We can't get them to want a thing that they don't want until we get them to see how it achieve something that they do want. And we can't get them to change what they believe quickly either. And so the second real big idea of the book and kind of at the heart of it is that this is really about how do you frame how you talk about an idea through the lens of what the person you're talking to or the people that you're talking to already want and already believe. And that may sound tricky, but it actually turns out to be much more straightforward, though it does ends up being a skill that people have to build. I'd say the third big thing that people will get from this book is that ideas are built, not found. And so I think sometimes we, as particularly as leaders and executives, we go in and say, well, if I can just say the one right word or the one right phrase, or just present them with the idea. Let me just show you the org chart or show you the new product. That somehow that's going to create that flash in their mind. But that's not how we as humans come up with ideas. We build them piece by piece. And so the third big thought in the book is that if you can break your idea into its component parts, the parts that someone's brain is looking for anyway, and make sure that that's in how you talk about it. Essentially what you're doing is you're able to rebuild that idea in someone else's mind in the same way it was built in yours in the first place.
So would you say that sometimes when people are trying to get their idea across, they simply make it too complicated?
I think it's it's one extreme or the other. And I think the most common thing that I see is that we just forget that people don't see the world the way that we do. I mean, it's a common cognitive bias that we believe that the people around us want and believe the same things. And we believe that because we know the answer is right, that if we just tell them the answer is right, that our product or our service or this idea, this new initiative is the right one, that people go, yeah, I see that. That's just simply not how it works. So I think that that's what it really starts there, is that we just forget that people don't see the world the way that we do. And the result of that is either we complicate it too much because we're using expert language and we're talking at, think of Google Maps as an analogy. We're giving people turn by turn directions about our idea when they don't even know what continent we're on. And the other thing that we do is we oversimplify it. And we just basically say to people, well, this is the right answer. And then when they say why, basically all your answers to that are because the answer is right. And so we end up with this big circular logic and it's a mess.
Well, it brings up a conversation I had the other day with somebody using the pandemic as an example. I said, there are 7 to 10 different experiences that people had. And the person was like, I don't know what you're talking about. We all lived through the pandemic. And I said, well, I had a conversation the other day with a friend who's a banker who didn't understand why people were complaining about financial hardships. Now, someone who made their living as a professional speaker to go from, several hundred thousand dollars a year to zero, that's a financial hardship. This person I was talking to was a banker and his checks never started. His $250,000 a year salary never stopped. He never missed a check. His hardship was he had to be home with his kids all day. And I'm like, wow, that's a different experience. And some people had people who got really sick. Some people had family members or friends who died. And I go, we could probably come up with 10 different pandemic experiences that people had that, we have to be thinking about that when we're talking about the last 14 months. And so you bring up a great point that this is true in everything we do. People look at the world through their own glasses.
Right. And the easiest way for them to see the value in your idea is to put on their glasses and to say, okay, I mean, I know my idea is right, but from where somebody's sitting, why might they feel that it's right? And that, you know, that does take practice. It's a practice that psychologists refer to as cognitive empathy. I think we're all used to like emotional empathy, which is like, oh, I can understand what someone is feeling, but cognitive empathy is what is somebody thinking? And that, if we can start to build that skill, can be incredibly important in helping make change much more effective. I mean, fundamentally, like I said, I was that first turn as a change management consultant never really ended. So I really consider what I do to be change communication. That was honed in my 13 years moonlighting as a Weight Watchers leader. Which I forgot to mention in my recap of my life.
I told you it was an eclectic life. That's just another layer to it.
It is. Yes. But it really is all about, I mean, I've just been so fascinated about how is it that people make a decision to change and how is it that we can, you know, in whatever role you play in that decision to change, how can you make that easier? Because one thing I've discovered through everything that I've done is that whether it's individual change or organizational change, pain is the enemy of long-term change. Like, can you make somebody do something? Well, if you're at the C-suite, absolutely you can. You can say you can do this or you're going to lose your job. This is, you know, essentially this is an order. I mean, because I say so, can work. But long-term, the costs of that are that you may be causing someone to take action, but you are not driving intrinsic, self-motivated, sustained changes in thinking or behavior, which if you're at the C-suite, it's those kinds of behavior that lead to engaged employees, much less turnover. Those are the kinds of things that ultimately save you money in the long term, because you're not going to have as many culture issues. You're going to have a lot more effectiveness in getting initiatives adopted and compliance with things that you're trying to get across. But it really does start with saying, well, why would they want to, other than the fact that I, as the C-suite executive or the leader, is telling them to.
So Tamsin, this is all fascinating. And I have a few more questions for you before I let you go. But first, I have to thank the other sponsor of this episode. So this episode, like all of them, is brought to you by Podfly Productions. Podfly takes the time and the headache out of creating your own podcast. They set you up with the right equipment, training, and guidance to ensure that you're going to sound amazing. Podfly does all the heavy lifting and that pesky technical work so that you can focus on creating great content, growing your audience, and interviewing people who are making waves in business like Tamsin Webster. Hey, if you want to start a podcast, and I know that some of you do, jump over right now to podfly.net/cool things and check out the offer that they have for the listeners of this show. And yes, everybody, I'm aware it is still podfly.net/cool things. And the show originally was called Cool Things Entrepreneurs Do. We've never changed the URL for you to get discounts. So you're going to have to think it probably should be podfly.net/makingwaves, but we've never made that change. And since we changed the name of the show, /cool things. All right. So, Tamsin, what are some of the big mistakes that you see people make? And let's look at marketing, because we all see the same marketing in the media and stuff like that. What are some mistakes that you see people make where they just don't have a red thread? They're just lost.
I would say the most common thing that I see in marketing and advertising is that is just not establishing relevance first. And that seems, it's a little counterintuitive, because I think a lot of people feel like, well, marketing, we're supposed to point out how we're different. Like, most people don't even cross the bar of making it clear, like, what the thing is that you are and that you're offering. And so I love to play this little game. Like, I'm a dedicated subscriber to the Harvard Business Review. I used to do this in airports. I'd pick up like Fast Company and whatever, and I'd flip through and I'd look at the ads, and then I would just be like, And I play this game of what's missing from this message. And so often, if you were to play a similar game, you'd realize that most of this advertising, most of the marketing doesn't actually even tell people what it is. They don't tell you that.
Well, the pharmaceutical companies are the worst about this. Try Lipinail. And it's like, what does it do?
The nail. Well, so at least they do a job. They do a good job usually of like articulating what the issue is that somebody's trying to solve, or painting the picture of what it looks like, you know, better than that. But that kind of let me intrigue you with something that's mysterious. Just isn't actually how our brains work. If we don't understand something immediately, if we don't have enough information to determine whether or not something's relevant, science shows that we are negatively curious about it. Like, not only are we not interested, we're like actively not interested. We will scoff at it and be like, I don't know what that means. Don't even give it the time of day. And worst case, when it comes to marketing your organization, that could mean, oh, that's the company that puts out those ads I don't understand.
And we've all seen we've all watched the Super Bowl and had that thought, right?
We don't have any idea.
Right.
Yeah. The great example of that, this is definitely dating both you and I.
I don't know about you, but I'm old and I'm fine with it. So
yeah, it's fine. Well, I can't even tell you how long it was, but I just remember at the time that like AT&T launched this big thing during the Super Bowl called M World. And it was like as if it was this magical thing, like this new thing. And they're like, M World. And they didn't explain what it was. It was very clearly like an attempt to get people to go find out what it was. Well, it was just their mobile plan, right? It was just like, there wasn't actually a there. But I make this point in some of the keynotes that I give. I was like, you know, the only people who follow those URLs in a written ad, I mean, this is different than podcasts, go here to get your discount. But here's this mysterious thing, go find this. Like the only people who follow that are marketers. And it just drives me nuts, as you can probably tell, because I call it the persuader's paradox, where what will end up happening is that we will do things to try to persuade other people that we fundamentally just absolutely would not tolerate when they're done to us. Or don't respond to when we're done to us. It's kind of like a classic, like in the early days of social, where all the agencies were like, you've got to have a Facebook page. You have to have a Facebook brand page. And then I would, you know, or a company would come to us and say, we've got to have a Facebook brand page. I'm like, how many Facebook brand pages do you go to? And they're like, none. And I'm like, well, do you really think that, you know, so I called myself the resident skeptic there. I think I still am in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
but I think that's a big mistake. It's just not connecting what you do to somebody's actual life right now.
Well, and I see that with like clients who do a lot of email marketing the fact that they, and I'm not saying email marketing is bad. When done well, it clearly has results.
100%.
But there are so many people who are like, oh, I send my newsletter. And I'm like, so tell me, you know, how many newsletters do you read? Oh, I delete them all. Very interesting. You know, that, or I was talking to a professional speaker who was telling me that he didn't want to get back on the road because virtual was way better. And he had all these reasons why he thought like virtual conferences rocked. And he was talking from the standpoint of the audience. And then I asked him, have you gone to anything virtually that like our association, the National Speakers Association, done this year? And he goes, I don't do this virtual crap. He goes, it's too hard and the networking sucks. You're on a timer for 3 minutes with somebody. And I'm
the persuader's paradox.
I'm like, let's go back to what you said earlier about how great it was if you're the speaker and how lame it is for everybody else. I go, I don't think those are different.
And that's exactly, you know, you've asked like, what is the problem? I mean, that is the problem. That is what happens over and over and over again, is that we get so caught up in why something is awesome for us that we just miss that. I'm not denying that it is awesome. Like maybe it is, but like you have to, people can't teleport to where you are. You have to go where they are mentally and draw that map back to the GPS analogy. And the first thing you have to do is give them an overview that says, oh, you're here. The thing you're looking for is over here. And by the way, you can't stop there, which is the second biggest mistake. A lot of times we just say, here's your problem. Here's the answer. And then we're like, and this is how you do it. And it's kind of like we kind of skip some steps that happen in people's minds because we're not rational decision makers. We're rationalizing decision makers. Something may sound great in the moment. You can give the most rah-rah talk to your team and your staff or as a speaker to an audience, and they may be fired up. And how many times has that happened? And then afterwards, nothing changes. That's because people's brains kind of in the moment, they're like, yes, that makes sense. But afterwards, when they start to rationalize the decision, first, their brain is going to do everything possible to rationalize why they shouldn't do something different, because that's how we're wired as humans. And second, a lot of times the case that we've made for an idea or a shift in thinking or behavior doesn't actually withstand that. Because when we start to think about it, they're like, well, they basically just said, this is the answer, but they didn't actually tell me why it's the right answer. They focused on all the features and benefits and all the stuff that I'd get, but that doesn't actually explain why it produces those or how it produces those and why that's actually different or important from what I'm doing now. And so basically their brains go, so I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing now because that's easier. And that's where things die on the vine.
So before we wrap this up, I just want to share, I put a giant star by something you said when you gave sort of the three main points. There was something you said that totally affected me for my business. So I'm just going to share it with everybody because it's probably true for everybody, no matter what business they're in. And that first thing was, and I'm paraphrasing it, that the people you're talking to inside a company, they might have to go sell it to somebody else. Are you putting it in the language so that they can go to their boss? As a speaker, how often do we talk to a meeting planner who has to go to a committee and the committee doesn't want to talk to 10 speakers? And I literally wrote, I circled it and wrote it down and thought, am I doing this? I do it to some extent, but that was my takeaway is, wow, everyone I talk to, I have to put in the language where they can go back and talk to that committee. So that was my takeaway from what you said.
Hey. Yeah, and that's one of the things that, you know, there's a talk that I give that's called Pressure Test Your Message. Sometimes I title it How to Make Your Ideas Irresistible, but either way, but that's actually, so there's a series of tests. You kind of, you pass one level, you can move on to the next. And the first one is relevance. And that's what we've talked about already. Like anchor whatever you're doing in something that, that somebody you're talking to wants right now, like actually wants right now, but doesn't yet have. That second piece is really important. They want, but they don't have it yet. That is A, irresistible by nature and automatically relevant. The second piece is it resilient? Will it withstand that rationalization that we're talking about? And really that's my whole book is about. How do you build that kind of really strong case for an idea? And the third piece is then, is it remarkable? Can you actually, because sometimes we say, well, you know what, when you're trying to make change, the real problem is that you're afraid of it. And the answer is you need to take like little baby steps to get past it. Well, people have heard that before, right? So it's like, it's not that it's not valid or it's not good, but if your business relies on your, like the differentiation, for instance, does your business rely on differentiation to justify the premium cost for your product or service? Giving something that people feel like they've heard before ain't going to cut it. And the last piece is, can you summarize, is it repeatable? Can people summarize the big idea of what you do in a single sentence that includes something that they want via a means they don't expect? So for instance, you know, if, you know, one of the, to use a TED talk, for example, Amy Cuddy's TED talk, you know, if I were to say, what's the red thread through line, that one sentence of her talk, it's that your body language may be a way to overcome imposter syndrome. So overcoming imposter syndrome is the thing that people want. And the body language piece is the piece that people hadn't heard before. So that's really interesting. And once you can lead with that, when someone says, hey, Tom, what's your talk about? Or what do you speak about? And you can say, huh, well, I talk to companies about how to make their ideas irresistible by helping them build stories that their audiences will tell themselves. That's enough for them to go, well, that's interesting. Tell me more. And that's when you follow up with that kind of really solid case that you've built. And I think that's that test of, can you summarize your concept, the thing that you're going to tell, you know, what your theme of your kickoff meeting is. I work with companies on doing that, like a major fitness organization where, you know, I work with them and what's the red thread of the conference. And then what's the red thread of the talks in it. You should be able to summarize and say, that's what this is, that the biggest way for us to achieve X is this unexpected, unfamiliar, perhaps unconventional answer. Now let me tell you more. And I think most people struggle to do that.
Well, this is awesome. And now I've just taken another page of notes as we've been talking. So that's fantastic. So Tamsin, if somebody is like, I must find out more about this Tamsin Webster, or they want to buy your book, how can they find you and how can they find the brand new book, Find Your Red Thread?
Easiest way to do that right now, to do both, is to go to redthreadbook.com, which will A, get you to all the goodies with the book. And if you buy multiple copies, different fun extras that you get, things like a digital bonus chapter on how to adapt your red thread for additional audiences, autographed copies, that kind of thing. But it also redirects to my site. So if you want to explore further from there, sign up for my newsletter, you can do all that right from redthreadbook.com.
That is awesome. Well, again, Tamsin Webster, thank you for being here. And thank you for everybody who tuned in and listened. I say it every single show. If it wasn't for the audience, why would we do this? It has been a great experience. I get to talk to people like Tamsin and learn a lot and take notes, and I get to share it with everybody who's listening. So make sure, if you like Making Waves at Sea Level, yes, like every podcaster, I want those reviews on Apple or Spotify that says, love the show, 5 stars, yay. However, more important, go tell a friend. When I talk to people and I ask them, how'd you find my little show? They always say they were recommended because a friend told them to listen. One person actually told me, my mother told me your podcast sucked less than others. And I said, you know what? I will take that as the best compliment of the day. So go out and tell your friends, because word of mouth is huge in the world I live in. So tell people about it. In the meantime, go out there, flex your business muscles. Make sure that your career ladder is against the correct wall. Make sure you have a red thread that you can pull through everything you do. And while you're out there doing it, hey, go out and have some fun. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Making Waves at Sea Level podcast. Without your listening to these in-depth conversations, there would be no show. Connect with Tom at tomsinger.com and follow him on Twitter and Instagram at Tom Singer.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.